again.
You're listening to Industrial Evolution. I'm your host, Chad Perry, CTO and software engineer. You can find more episodes and contact information on our website, industrial.fm. Enjoy the show, and if you need help with custom software, data integrations, or strategy, be sure to reach out. That's industrial.fm. Today, we're speaking with Tony Bevilacqua, founder and CEO of Cognitive 3D out of Vancouver, Canada. Cognitive 3D is an AR and VR software company that aims to change the way human behavior is measured and analyzed. And they're accomplishing that mission by way of an enterprise software platform that enables real-world insights to be pulled from virtual environments, and more specifically from training and research simulations, which are relevant across all kinds of businesses and job functions. This is going to be a fascinating conversation because as cool as it is to have the latest headset or whatever toy it may be in a business setting, it's kind of pointless if you can't meaningfully get information out of the system. Deriving real-world meaning from the virtual world is a cornerstone of Industry 4.0, which puts cognitive 3D at the heart of this revolution, enabling new ways of looking at our physical world and its digital twin. So Tony is joining us today to reveal the future of measuring human performance in AR and VR. Tony, great to have you with us today.
Hey, Chad. Thanks for having me.
Now, let's start with your background, because this isn't your first rodeo. It seems like you've been an entrepreneur since day one. So how did you get started, and what led you to the intersection of XR and human performance?
Yeah. So I started a while back. I mean, when I left high school, I kind of just jumped right into IT and started in that space. But it was really clear to me that I wanted to do startups. So I started to work remotely for a company called Kinetic. And over the years, kind of evolved into a founder in that particular company, moving down to Florida and growing what ended up being a revenue optimization platform, which had a really strong analytics component to it. We grew that company to 30 plus engineers, a few million dollars in revenue. And we ended up selling that to one of our customers in late 2014. And, you know, during that time, during that process of building that organization, we had a lot of customers that were in the game development space. And, you know, I got opportunities to go to game development conference and E3 and saw some really early prototypes in the VR space, you know, specifically towards games and entertainment. And when I was looking at what I was doing versus, you know, what the capabilities were, mobile on kind of like a 2D plane, but more in 3D with immersive-based devices, I really kind of realized that there was a massive opportunity to build something really innovative in understanding spatial behavior and how people are interacting with 3D space.
Now, that's quite a leap, though, because if you think about gaming, your outcome for the end user is a lot different than an enterprise environment. I mean, you could argue that that's not exactly the same because gamification plays into the business setting. Is this something that you were actually seeing enterprise customers demand, or was this just kind of an idea that you eventually validated somehow?
Yeah, so I think it's good that you pointed that out. I mean, when we started this business, we were thinking games and entertainment. And that's really what the excitement was all about back in 2015 when we formed this company. This particular organization was originally focused on analytics for games, entertainment, for virtual reality. But what we started to do is we started building a product around that and exploring some of the opportunities that some of the capabilities that were kind of offered by using VR as a vehicle for data collection. We ended up launching a freemium product, so kind of an initial product we were offering to game developers, and something weird started happening. And that weird thing was companies like Accenture and ExxonMobil and others were signing up to our platform and trying to get access to our gaming tool, which I thought was really bizarre. And, you know, when we started to explore these use cases further, it was really clear to us that, like, game developers, you know, didn't really want to pay for Unity, you know, let alone analytics. But on the enterprise side, there was just massive value in what they were doing. They were building like solutions to big problems for their organization. And, you know, we ended up making a pivot in 2017 or so towards enterprise only and dropping the entire game business. We were actually supporting 300, 400 game developers. We had to make a pretty substantial change to move towards the enterprise market.
I was kind of thinking when you were describing that, I wonder if they actually had any gaming customers. I mean, I actually look at this and, you know, I'm not that familiar with the gaming world. So I kind of look at this and go, why would you need analytics in gaming? It seems obvious to go into the enterprise space.
On the gaming side, it was really just about, you know, understanding user behavior on a completely new medium, right? So when you're looking at building, you know, content that users were immersed in, there was a lot of question marks, right? About what made ideal content, what was safe, what was healthy, what made people feel comfortable. And a lot of big questions that game developers and entertainment companies needed to answer. And we felt that we could fill that with, you know, this particular technology and help the game developers understand that. But when we started building out our tools, we accidentally built After Action Review, you know, trying to build a tool set to kind of help gamers or game developers understand user behavior. And that particular tool set had a completely different application in the enterprise space that was much higher value than what we were trying to provide in games and entertainment.
I would think that those questions that are being asked would actually be the same in an enterprise environment, just with a different outcome in mind. Is that the case? Or did you start to see different questions and different demands on the product?
In the early days, it was very much similar, right? So when we, in the early days of enterprise, when it was all about POCs and pilots, it was very much similar in that they wanted to understand comfort levels, how did employees respond to simulations, you know, what could we learn about content creation for enterprise? So a lot of the questions that they had were very similar, but in a different context. When we think about the questions that they're asking today, it's more about employee performance and human performance and training outcomes and being able to tie those to existing systems. So I think that the need and the demand for insight has changed over time towards a more valuable goal within the enterprise.
What you're describing is a maturity of the technology, because XR isn't new. It's not new. It's not even new to the enterprise. But it's also not a fully mature technology. So we're witnessing this growth not only in the early days of the capability, but as people figure out how to use it. So where do we stand today in general? Can you give me a big picture of VR capabilities versus, let's say, the last 5 to 10 years? And what kind of uptake are you seeing out there in terms of useful application for this technology as it matures?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, when I think about spatial technology and immersive simulation, this industry has been around for 30 plus years, goes all the way back to JPL and, you know, some of the work they did in immersive simulators and cave-based systems and immersive domes and all sorts of very expensive things that, you know, were done by the defense and aerospace industry. These were one-off bespoke technology created, you know, from scratch for a very particular purpose. And, you know, this was really the only acceptable way to get access to these types of simulations because the cost of entry to the technology and to the capability was so very, very, very high. So when you're thinking about, you know, a jet that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars and building a training program or a simulator that's worth several million, that's, you know, acceptable. You know, to that particular program. But when you start trying to apply it to other business objectives, you know, it just, there's barriers to entry in being able to make the platform scale. With the evolution of the Oculus and the Rift and Palmer Luckey's efforts with, you know, that, you know, kind of commoditizing or building a more consumer accessible VR device, it kind of created this whole revolution of progress in VR technology and really kind of started a firestorm of, you know, technical innovation that's driven down cost, but also dramatically increased capability, including things like field of view, pixel density, eye tracking biometrics, all these different capabilities that were really required to kind of give you that sense of presence and that capability to be in the environment with your simulated content. So now, you know, fast forward 2015, all these major players start getting involved. They start shipping new headsets, new capabilities. That's only evolved over the last 5 years. And in 2020, we've got a number of extremely high quality headsets available for, you know, some, in some cases, $1,000 or less, that provide, you know, enterprise simulator capability to enterprises worldwide. So you've basically reduced the cost and scope of, I want to build a simulator, from, you know, a multi-million dollar project with software engineering and 3D development, down to, you know, we're going to do some 3D based development in Unity or Unreal, and we're going to buy, you know, X number of headsets. It's going to cost us in the thousands. So that change and that shift in the accessibility of the hardware has really driven this mass adoption by the enterprise in first exploring the tool set, building those POCs and pilots, and then starting to evolve the maturity there into actual use cases and in production.
We're talking about something that kind of started out and was driven by the gaming industry. I think of this as, in an organization, you could have a lot of people that are curious, and maybe you have an engineer or, you know, somebody who's trying to solve a specific problem. But based on our conversation when we first spoke, you're talking about big companies. They have these innovation departments, and they're wanting to bring that technology into the realm of useful software, useful hardware, useful experience. So what are you seeing in terms of these innovation departments? Where are they in terms of adoption? Are they actually using the latest headsets, or are they making bespoke solutions? What's going on?
Yeah, in a lot of cases, we're kind of moving past the innovation team and into more production style deployments. You know, in the early days, the jury was still out on this technology and if it was going to work at all, right? If you think about it, there's a lot of risk associated with, you know, picking up some gaming hardware and saying that this is the next big thing for enterprise, right? There was a lot of testing, a lot of exploration that needed to occur to be able to adopt, you know, this technology within the enterprise. And there was a lot of testing that needed to be done with how this might apply to our organization, and how we might be able to scale it to solve, you know, different problems that we might have in training simulation or even in research-based uses. So, you know, typically where I saw things start was in the innovation team, you know, really early days. They would, you know, buy a bunch of hardware. You know, maybe they would hire a contractor or bring an internal team on board to produce a few prototypes, right? And they'd usually pick a simulation that was difficult, right? It offered a pain point. It usually had some sort of cost factor, risk factor associated with it to either, you know, team, employees, equipment, you know, something along those lines. And, you know, with that, they were able to kind of, you know, see, you know, could we emulate, you know, this environment that we typically train in person? And does it create an ROI for the organization that would justify creation of, you know, 3D-based simulations and tools and buying headsets and changing how we do training?
Yeah, you've mentioned risk a few different times. So one of the questions I have around that is, what actually is that risk to adopting something that's low cost? Because on the one hand, you're talking about scaling up and deployment. That makes sense, right? If you're going to build out an engineering team, if you're going to invest in Unity or Unreal Engine and a team that can actually do something useful for that. But in terms of actually being able to show a solution to a problem, it seems like from an outside perspective that it would be pretty easy just to buy a couple of headsets and to test drive it. So what were they so worried about?
Well, I think it's more about tried and true processes, right? And I think, you know, there's the risk that I'm talking about is that, you know, organizations typically have a very specific way they do things, right? And those ways might be expensive, right? And they might be, you know, legacy, you know, they use video and slides and all sorts of other things. But they work, or they work well enough that the organization has deployed them and they've deployed them in scale. So I think that there's, you know, when they're looking at these situations, there's a lot of different stakeholders that really need to buy in on the effectiveness of the tool and that it's not going to create additional risk, right? You know, when we're thinking about the use case that I'm going to discuss a little bit later in our discussion, you know, there was a lot of concern around training employees the wrong way on how to do something, or introducing opportunities where the employee could train in a way that was not the way that things were supposed to be done. And, you know, the simulation then, you know, came into the view of a lot of different stakeholders within the organization, because best practices were, you know, at the forefront, and we needed to make sure that the best practices were actually followed for employees. And then we weren't imprinting spatial knowledge on people that did not match what they are going to experience out in the field. You know, VR has a incredible and enormous capability to provide, you know, basic spatial knowledge and the ability to, you know, kind of consume that knowledge in more effective ways. And it also has, you know, kind of a damaging element to it, that if that knowledge is incorrect, it will be absorbed by the workforce.
Right. So you're amplifying it either way. You're amplifying it whether it's wrong or right.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, and now it makes a lot more sense, because if you have somebody like Accenture or a large consulting company coming to you, their reputation, their liability is on the line, because they're proposing advanced solutions to their clients. And so the last thing they want to do is take something in and say, hey, you guys should deploy this. Although it would be different if it's just, hey, let's come in and prototype this. How does that relate to human performance? How is human performance traditionally measured? And how are things changing?
It's measured traditionally. And what I mean by that is, you know, we're talking about kind of qualitative observation, right? So, you know, there's traditional methods, which means you're being surveyed by somebody who may have bias, right? You're being evaluated by an instructor or a trainer. You're being evaluated by, you know, kind of offline testing, or even just the consumption of media, right? So did you, or were you delivered a particular set of training? And, you know, in traditional platforms, that might be as simple as checking a box. Yes, they watched the video. The video played. We don't know if they actually watched it, but, you know, the video played. And that doesn't necessarily ensure that knowledge was transferred and retained to the end user. So when we're talking about human performance, we're talking about evaluating in a non-biased way the user's compliance with a particular structure, a particular process that they need to do to stay safe and to do the work right, that's not going to cause injury to them or damage to any sort of equipment or other type of you know, situation like that. So I think that that's, you know, kind of the main difference, is that we're moving away from kind of these traditional processes of you know, training in old methods with a people-based approach, and moving into something that's a little bit more scalable, includes less bias, and has a better level of knowledge retention than any traditional training we've ever seen.
All enabled by this commodity hardware that's now available to build out completely new environments.
Yeah, it's really kind of the limits are kind of in the eyes of the beholder in terms of the simulation that gets created, right? And it can be really a spectrum of content, from virtual reality to augmented to mixed reality, right? From doing work instructions in a physical environment all the way to creating a very difficult to reproduce scenario that would potentially put the employee in a lot of risk on a scenario that they don't get to train on very often for real, because there's just no opportunity to do so. Right. So, you know, VR kind of opens up those opportunities to train users, train employees on things that you might not be able to get a lot of reps on.
It's almost comical to, and it's quite interesting to see how things, I mean, I think that in another 10, 20 years, we're going to look back and go, how did we ever train in an analog world? I actually remember when I was doing my aerospace engineering degree, they had this old, it was like one of those toys you find outside of the grocery store where you put the quarter in and you kind of ride it. It was an airplane, and it had a basic set of instruments in it, but there was no visual component to it whatsoever. And that used to be a serious mode of training. And I can't even imagine that being effective, but it was. So of course, visually immersive environments are going to be.
Do you know what's really frightening, Chad? Do you know what's really frightening? That's probably expensive. Whatever you were, you know, thinking like this thing looks like a ridiculous toy. That was probably really expensive. And they probably spent a lot of time and money building that thing.
Yeah. And in fact, speaking of the environment and getting past the risk, this is a double-edged sword because you've got, I would say, potential physiological impacts of this new environment as well. What are the physical risks of actually using this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this has been one of those things that's really improved over the last 5 years. You know, when you back in 2015, maybe in like the DK2, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, people were building apps that, you know, they would just refer to as vomit simulators because they were just so jarring, you know, to put users into. And there's just so much opportunity for users to get motion sickness and really just feel ill in using these simulations. And a lot of that is really just the decoupling of the user's behavior to what they're seeing in real space, right? So if you have a terrible, you know, motion of photon or, you know, something along those lines where what you see is not how you're behaving, you know, maybe you move your head and it doesn't feel right. That's going to make you feel sick. And, you know, over the last few years, what we've seen is massive technical advancement to eliminate a lot of that issue. You know, if we think about the issues that exist back in 2016, I'm thinking, you know, limited field of view, screen door effects. So when you put on a VR headset, you could see kind of like a screen door type of thing if you really focused on what you were looking at through the goggles. You know, lack of ability to configure your IPD, which is basically, you know, every person has, you know, individual and unique spacing between their eyes. If you get that off, it just feels off, you know, completely. And now we're getting to a point with the new headsets and new capabilities, you know, you've basically eliminated screen door effect. We've introduced massively accurate hand tracking. So you can, you know, stabilize yourself by seeing other fixed elements within the experience that you can see and feel, like your hands moving through space. We've eliminated or improved the refresh rate on the headsets. A lot of the, you know, kind of the key capabilities that were required to eliminate those particular problems have been deployed in the 2012 class of hardware that you're seeing in the market today.
Is that something that as an individual or a leader who is bringing this technology into the organization or making a decision, is that something that they have to be aware of? Or is that something that's just kind of fixed across the board and it was just a legacy problem?
No, it was a roadblock, right? So it was an actual detractor to deploying these things at scale. You know, if that was typically, you know, when we're doing our early enterprise use cases back 2016, 2017, it was an active detractor on the ability to deploy the hardware, because I think that most stakeholders understood the opportunity and understood the capability of what they could bring to market, what they could bring to their employees, but it just wasn't good enough, right? Like it just didn't offer the capabilities that were required. It didn't provide a level of comfort across all your employees, you know, or it didn't reflect the graphics and the capabilities that you needed to be able to represent to make this look like the real world. A lot of those problems have now been solved and opened up the opportunity to deploy these at scale because everything is so like the real world and the work environment they would typically be in.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's really what has created the opportunity for Cognitive 3D to exist, is because once you've solved this technology problem, you set up an environment, it might be a hard-coded proof of concept, but essentially you're talking about a data silo. So I kind of think of you guys as an enabler of really just like a set of pipes to pull out that data, and then on top of that, make use of it somehow to measure it, to analyze it, to make decisions around it. So is that, am I getting that right, or is there more to it than that?
No, I think that you're on the right track. You know, Cognitive 3D, we're a spatial analytics platform, and where we're special is exactly what you had mentioned. We provide a software development kit that any enterprise can integrate into their content. So if they have an existing simulation that they've been working on for 4 years, or they've got something new coming up, in either scenario, they can simply integrate the Cognitive 3D platform and they get turnkey tools, turnkey capabilities, to be able to understand and measure how people are interacting within those 3D spaces. So it's really kind of like a turnkey type of approach, and it gives them an ability to do things like after action review, do non-biased measurement of objective results and sequences. So there's a lot of capability that's brought to the table just by simply integrating Cognitive 3D.
Is there an integration process that has to happen there, or are there existing connectors for common events that come out of virtual environments?
Yeah, it's both. So when you integrate the SDK, it automatically connects to all the major data sources. So it'll take your eye tracking data, your head motion data, your hand controllers, all that type of stuff. It'll automatically all ingest that all and make the tools available on the Cognitive 3D platform. Sometimes there's business specific logic that you'll want to add on top of that. So some things that are a little bit more specific to your scenario. But the purpose of Cognitive 3D is to simply integrate that SDK. It'll automatically tap into 90% of what you need, and then maybe add a little bit more business logic depending on what your scenario does and how it works.
That's actually a big problem in Industry 4.0 is we have plenty of data, but making use of that data, or actually more accurately, making decisions and being able to interpret the important parts of that data seem to be the real challenge. So when I think about you telling me that it's ingesting eye tracking and all kinds of what sound like essentially biometric, biophysical data, that sounds like a lot of data, and I don't know how to make use of that.
It is a lot. Yeah, absolutely. It is a lot. And I think the important piece here is that I understand the kind of the concepts behind data lakes and, all this like massive amount of data, and enterprises have no idea what to do with it. And it's created a lot of fragmentation within the enterprise as well around how decisions are made, how that data is going to be used. Cognitive 3D, we ingest a lot of data to be able to empower our tools. Our tools are very specifically designed to give you that insight into exactly what users are doing. So while the ones and zeros that we collect off of a spatial application include, what the user might be looking at and how they're moving their head, how that's visualized is not in a spreadsheet. Our approach is entirely 3D. We provide visualization tools that give you that contextual view into what a user is doing. And we also provide the tools to analyze that data automatically with tools like the Objective System. And tools like that has really been a big turning point for us because, if you think about something like Scene Explorer is a traditional after-action review. The defense and aerospace industry has been using these for many, many years, just like they have been using these caves and domes and simulators. And, after-action review is a really good opportunity to provide more distributed training capabilities for enterprises kind of across the board. Trainer doesn't need to be in the room. Employee can do self-directed training, within a 3D environment. The after-action review gives the view into the stakeholder, what this employee did, what process did they follow, and how did they engage. When we started trying to scale this tool set and, make it more valuable for our customers, the biggest concern that they had was exactly what you said earlier. This is fantastic, Tony. I only want to dive into an individual when something goes wrong. Scene Explorer is way too much for day-to-day insights. And so what we ended up doing is creating a new set of tools called the Objective System. And what that does is it actually takes all the data that we talked about before and evaluates it against processes. Right? So you can identify what does success look like for this particular simulation. The platform will automatically evaluate that user for the human performance outcomes of that particular simulation. And you'll be able to see the results on an aggregate basis as well as an individual basis. Now, you as a trainer, you're looking at this data and you see a number of your cohort not doing well. Scene Explorer is that great opportunity to be able to jump in and, be a fly on the wall in the room. On a simulation that you weren't present for and be able to see what happened, what went wrong, and what is the assist that I could provide to this particular employee.
Is that essentially a secondary simulation where the after-action reviewer can go back into the virtual environment and see what happened?
It's a full 3D replay. They can literally watch exactly what that user did and how they behaved.
And so you could see something like, I wonder what they were looking at this exact moment in time, and was it the expected outcome that we were hoping for?
Exactly. Not to mention that, we can also evaluate what they didn't look at, right? So a lot of what Objectives does, as well as Scene Explorer, is situational awareness, being able to understand hazards, being able to understand situations where, you know, the employee might be distractive or be under high cognitive load, being able to identify all of these programmically and, you know, provide outcomes to trainers is incredibly powerful and gives a lot of opportunity to prevent loss of life, injury, equipment, you know, damage or destruction, all sorts of opportunities to put users in these simulations and give them opportunities to build those repetitions on content that would be very difficult to train on in the real world.
Yeah, not to mention the real-time possibilities, because if you're doing self-directed training, you could, in theory, get immediate feedback if you're missing something. So if you're missing a critical component of situational awareness.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, when I think of things moving forward, our primary data consumer right now is the trainers and L&D managers and other stakeholders that are actually delivering these programs and capabilities. But, you know, I also see a future where the employees would be able to get direct feedback, including reports and outcomes and other types of report cards that give them an idea of where they went wrong and how they might be able to improve their performance within a particular simulation.
So you're not just regurgitating data in a spreadsheet. You're actually taking advantage of the new technology for the purpose of evaluation as well. So you've got an innovation on two different fronts.
Exactly. I think if we're trying to boil it down, the problem that Cognitive 3D is trying to solve is how do we scale these things? And how do we tie these things into legacy processes within the enterprise, right? And that's really where we have been focused in, you know, most of Cognitive 3D's customers are on the more mature side of the equation, because the types of problems that they're trying to solve is, I've created a fantastic POC, I've created a fantastic pilot, I've got some sort of, kind of ancillary number about how this might improve performance or cut cost in the enterprise or improve safety. But, you know, how are we going to measure this long term? How do we tie it into our existing systems? How do we work with the existing stakeholders? And Cognitive 3D provides a lot of systems that answer a lot of those questions.
Yeah, and you really touched on the crux of the issue is scaling it up. So you go from a POC to a fully deployed solution in a large organization. So let's talk about that. What does that process look like? I mean, what do you do when a customer first comes to you? What is the question that they have?
Yeah, so usually the question that they have is, we've got this new simulation that we're working on and we need to analytic. And it's just kind of like, okay, so you want data for the sake of data. When you start digging into the crux of the issue and what they're trying to do, ultimately they've got a number of different enterprise problems that they're trying to solve. They've got this kind of disconnected, disjointed VR-based simulation that they've created. It solves a really specific problem, but they don't necessarily have a way to deploy that, scale it, take it to the workforce in a tangible way. So when you start digging in, the types of things that they're really trying to solve are really around introducing scalability to the VR or augmented mixed reality solution that they're deploying. And also working with the organization, providing the tools that they need to be able to integrate this new training strategy into the organization, which has massive amounts of legacy-based modules and training and learning modules and things like that. So that's usually where we land. There's usually interest in just like, we want to collect data and see what the capabilities are. And where we usually end up is, we'll use data to be able to answer ongoing and programmatic outcomes for your employees.
Yeah, that's really a matter of discovery. A lot of people have an awareness, a lot of enterprise organizational leaders and innovators have an understanding of what's available, but they might be focused on one specific part of it. So part of your job and your function as a competent service provider and as a technology partner is to crawl back up the chain, the value chain, ask the questions of what are you trying to accomplish?
Exactly. And a lot of our stakeholders have experience in deploying mobile applications or existing training modules. And they know that they need to collect data. They know that they need to do something on this particular application. The question is what, right? And we even end up meeting with a lot of L&D managers who understand the breadth of opportunity from a biometric perspective, but they don't necessarily understand how that necessarily is going to map to tangible outcome for their enterprise. So, you know, it's not about retention, you know, like, or the number of sessions that you get per month, or traditional kind of 2D mobile Google Analytics style metrics. This is more about human performance outcomes and answering questions about employees and how compliant and complete they're being in their training. So helping educate those stakeholders on the capability, helping them understand that breadth of data and how it can be used in a tangible way, as opposed to just collecting for the sake of collecting, and how it can potentially solve a particular measurement issue that you might have. So just as a very broad example, we can do eye tracking and biometrics. That's fun. Like, let's do that. That's not a problem that you're trying to solve. Eye tracking introduces the opportunity to understand spatial awareness and the user's risk within a particular scenario. It can also help imply things like cognitive load. So being able to understand when an employee has reached a threshold within a particular experience where they become overloaded with stimuli, and it's unlikely that they're going to consume any more knowledge and retain that knowledge. So there's opportunities to use this data in really tangible ways.
Yeah, that's such a great way to put it too. The data presents an opportunity to do something else useful. And that's really what Industry 4.0 is all about. That's really what technology ultimately is about, right? It's about freeing up humans to do more things that are more human. What is the next step? How does this actually unfold once you've had that conversation?
So it usually typically, you know, we get plugged into whatever existing content that they have, and we start looking at, you know, how can this be measured, and, you know, how can we provide you a programmatic tangible outcome to a particular scenario? You know, it usually comes even during the discovery phase, we're usually talking about capability, right? The capability that a lot of people are interested in is not just about the analytics. You know, at the end of our discussion, it's all about how can I use that data and those outcomes and map those kind of into those existing processes. We talk a lot about LMS, learning management systems. We talk about XAPI, you know, some of the capabilities and standards around that. We talk about some of the different stakeholders and players that are kind of in the organization, both on subject matter experts that are, you know, part of the construction of the content through to other roles within the organization, including, you know, IT, health and safety, ergonomics, you know, all of those categories as well. So there's a lot of different kind of stakeholders that are involved. And a lot of what Cognitive 3D brings to the table is helping kind of solve a lot of the pain points that you might have in lining up a solution with those stakeholders.
Yeah. And how does an implementation typically go? Because you just mentioned a lot of different types of stakeholders that could potentially be in conflict. I know in large enterprise software implementations, which is where my background is, that can be an issue. Everybody sees the world in a slightly different way, sometimes very different, and sometimes they have different objectives. But this seems like something that's pretty clear cut, right? L&D owns the training experience. So how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely subject matter experts in every simulation. You know, I think that by the time it gets to Cognitive 3D, a lot of those discussions have usually happened at that point. The content is already in production. A lot of the pain points have been removed in that particular area. You know, one of the things that I see a lot of enterprises do that's a bit of a mistake is they try to build this stuff in a bit of a silo. So they'll go off as an innovation team and build out a whole bunch of different scenarios and start testing them with different employees, and not factor those stakeholders early on in the conversation. And when you don't get that buy-in, you don't get that, you know, kind of participation from, you know, basically the entire group of stakeholders, I feel like you get more resistance, you know, in trying to jam some sort of deployment strategy down their throat at a later point in time for content that they might not necessarily be bought in on. We have to remember that that we're talking about wholesale change of how data's or knowledge is going to be consumed by the workforce. There's potential implications on worker safety, which could include you know, health and safety functions, unions, and all sorts of other elements that need to be considered. And you know, it's just really important to identify who the different stakeholders are going to be and building a scalable deployment within the organization, and maybe form a committee or get those stakeholders involved early so they can provide some of their concerns. And some of those can be worked out early on in the process when the content's being constructed and the strategy is being formed.
I'm curious why you think that is, that this often happens in silos.
Yeah, I think it's easier to not involve anybody. I mean, if you're just a bunch of people in the bunker and you've got a bunch of cool VR hardware, it's pretty easy to go down there and geek out for a couple of years and build some really cool simulations, right? I don't think it's malice or anything along those lines. I think it's really just trying to avoid red tape. But, you know, I think that once you get into POC and you build something that's tangible, I think it's time to showcase, right? I think it's time to start selling. And we're not talking about selling employees. We're talking about selling all the different stakeholders within the organization on what the technology is capable of, how it's going to change our world, how it's going to train this how it's going to change this company and why that's a good thing. And getting those stakeholders bought in early on.
How would you push that in an organization, or how would you encourage the people who can actually make that change happen in an organization? What should they do differently to ensure that those stakeholders are brought together and made a part of this process? And this is a good lesson for any kind of technology in an organization.
Yeah, I mean, typically what I suggest kind of, if it's early enough, is to form a committee around the technology and include not just the technologists themselves, but all the different, you know, stakeholders kind of across the business that, are interested in this technology and could potentially be, attractors versus detractors to this particular situation. By forming that committee, you can create buy-in over time, especially if the time frame of building these POCs and pilots and doing all the hard work that needs to be done is a period of a few years. Suddenly you have, excitement in these different departments about some of the work that's being done. The tools and capabilities are being showcased, the results are being shown, and, you get a lot more buy-in from those committee members early on in the process. So that's usually my biggest suggestion versus just trying to go to IT and get some new software approved. That's usually doesn't work out very well.
Right, and that's kind of boring. I mean, what you're describing makes a lot of sense. You get people excited about it, you get people invested in it, and potentially they're going to invest in you and that outcome, and give you greater leeway, give you greater authority to get that out into the organization, as well as, of course, feedback and early input so that you can make sure that the product is as good as possible.
And we've seen some pretty spectacular explosions, especially when it comes to the IT function and some of these other areas. It's like, oh, cool, you guys created like some biometric nightmare and you want me to rubber stamp it in like 3 days. It's like, you're not buying Slack. Like this is different, right? So, a lot of the questions that we've hit from, the IT function suddenly pivoted away from, is cognitive 3D software secure, over to a whole bunch of health and safety and ergonomics issues. And, are the stakeholders bought in? And suddenly you've got this massive snowball rolling down the hill and it's completely out of control.
Not to mention it doesn't have anything to do with cognitive or analytics.
It doesn't, right? So that's a lot of delay on my side. So from a selfish perspective, please, include your stakeholders when you're building this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, but it's also an opportunity to be a shepherd of that process, right? Because these are things that are just natural human tendencies in an organization. So you can really act as a partner, especially if you get in there early.
For sure. And I we've had some multi-year conversations with a lot of different enterprises. So, we'll often be hit up, a year before it's time, and they're early on in their process. And we'll have a very candid call like this one, where I talk a little bit about some of our experience, some of the things they should look out for. I'll ask them pointed questions about like, hey, so, have you talked to IT about any of this stuff? And, then they can at least start the conversations, before we get into a situation where they're trying to, get a purchase order done with Cognitive.
So is that the only or the biggest objection that you typically see, or are there other objections that somebody should look out for as they're going down this process?
Not really. I think that, the biggest ones for me, it's definitely that IT function, but it's also the health and safety and really the subject matter experts for the specific job functions. Getting buy-in from the different job functions is actually really, really important. And I think that some people who are building prototypes and POCs kind of forget that on a day-to-day basis, there might be a workforce of, 20,000 people, out, doing their day-to-day work, and, deploying new training to them is actually a really, really big deal. And making sure that you bring in the appropriate stakeholders, not just from, you've got one supervisor that told you how to do this particular function, but all the people that were involved in, building the courseware and the processes and the safety measures and other types of things in that training over the years. So I think there's certainly that piece of it as well, is that the content needs to be right, it needs to be accurate, and it needs to mimic reality for buy-in to be successful.
Can you tell me about a situation maybe that you're quite proud of, or that's very representative of what the best case scenario is that's possible to really see this through from end to end?
Yeah, absolutely. So we work in the energy and the utility space pretty broadly. And there's a lot of workers and end employees out there that have to do a lot of dangerous work in the field. And we're working with a few different utility companies that had a very specific problem that they were trying to solve. The first one, it's actually two problems. The first one was, it was really difficult for them to be able to keep everybody on par with the skills or skill set and the processes that they were supposed to follow in the field. They had a centralized training model. So that meant that when the crew wasn't busy, they would need to go to a central location and get trained for a week. It was expensive, wasn't scalable. It was really difficult to kind of maintain. That's the one problem. The second problem that they had was when they hired new employees, when they brought new employees into the organization, they often traded positions over and over again between all the different utility providers, jockeying for new titles, new salaries, those types of things. So being able to assess knowledge really quickly on a new employee to kind of see what level they're at and if they're going to end up killing themselves in the field, by not taking a job that they're not necessarily qualified for, became a real problem. And where VR kind of came into both of those scenarios is on one side, they suddenly had this capability to send low cost simulators out for a very traditional job to a remote location. Those simulations could be executed, the data could be collected, and the trainer, when things go wrong, had the opportunity to review, right, and be able to assess and provide feedback on a distributed basis. And that was really the first piece that they solved. On the second side of it, they created a very specific process where they put these new employees into simulators, and very quickly, based off of the tried and true industry practices, could identify employees that just absolutely did not know what they were doing, did not meet the criteria of being a particular skill level, and you'd be able to identify that situation very quickly. So they used it kind of for two different perspectives.
Yeah, and that really highlights something that we haven't talked about explicitly, and that is the value proposition here. There are multiple value propositions. One is really a more efficient, scalable way to do training, right? So you move from this old model where it's centralized, where it's expensive to bring people on site, to a more efficient model where you can send out hardware and software, and then you can have a virtual world and a virtual link. And then the other is arguably the most important, which is impact on human life, health, and safety.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that second point is actually the most important, right? And what cognitive 3D tools do really, really well is the ability to assess that automatically. It's not qualitative in nature. It's not one human, kind of observing another human in whatever form factor that they have the capabilities of doing so. It tells no lies. It has, a level of honesty with it that's unsurpassed. And, if you can quantitatively measure exactly how a individual performs against a process, you've got a very tangible outcome. The user got 87% on this test, and these are the areas that they failed to do well on. you know, and it does kind of feed into some of the scalability pieces that we mentioned in the former use cases, right? A lot of this training is delivered in person. It's done in a group, so not necessarily one-on-one. And it's done, you know, in a practical sense. So there is no simulator, right? There's no traditional aerospace or defense type simulator. This is, you know, practical one-on-one training with a subject matter expert. And, you know, hopefully they catch if you did it wrong or not, right? And, you know, when you're talking about the scalability side, we're also talking about scalability and the ability to improve the knowledge capture and retention that the user is ultimately going to have in using this type of technology. And the ability to assess this data more accurately to be able to understand, you know, how compliant they were within the simulation as well.
Yeah, and that really speaks to where cognitive 3D fits into that value chain, where you're really having an impact on safety. You can't do that unless you have adequate information to be able to make that judgment. So if you don't know that that 87%, if you don't know that that employee is qualified to do that job, you're not going to be able to achieve that safety outcome. So that's a much stronger use case, I would think, for cognitive 3D.
And it was really apparent when we did a couple of case studies in this particular use case that unfortunately the customer bought them in such a way that they didn't want them distributed. But in this particular use case, they were literally, you know, one-on-one with every single employee, you know, trying to provide this training. And it was a very inefficient process. And, you know, the way that they were trying to transfer this knowledge seemed, at least from my perspective, that they would train a supervisor and then the supervisor was responsible for training the crew. They had kind of worked around the scalability problem by trusting that this one supervisor was going to train his crew properly. And, you know, the opportunity, at least this particular organization was looking at is, you know, we can create 5 to 10 simulators in each of our locations and make sure that the entire crew gets trained on industry standards and outcomes. And we're measuring all of them effectively, as opposed to putting a lot of trust in the health and safety on just one individual supervisor that may or may not have a good learning training and ability to transfer that knowledge effectively.
That applies to a lot of different safety critical environments. But having an aviation background, I actually think about aviation accidents where the probability of having a problem is low, but it happens when you have a series of failures. And so if you have any kind of deviation in that training model, it could potentially introduce a risk or I would say an anomaly or maybe a situation where you're not prepared. And I could see that in oil and gas. I could see that in aviation. I could see that in utilities as well.
And that's one of the things that we learned when we were working with these customers is that there was a lot of bad habits that had been formed. They knew what they were doing, right? Like they knew how to do their work and how to do it safely, but they had learned a number of different bad habits from being out on job sites and not necessarily getting that training and those reps in. And the great opportunity with this is suddenly you have these simulators and they're available for people that are not flying aircraft. And, you know, me in a traditional job out in the field in my truck every day, you know, suddenly I have the capability to do reps on my work that I'm not exposed to danger. And I think that that's a really powerful outcome.
So is it fair to say that you would be able to enforce standardization that is otherwise not possible, like in such a way that you can catch those minor things that are missed, but could be amplified in an emergency situation?
For sure. I think that it also introduces the opportunity to do reps on things that are not necessarily standard, not necessarily things that you're going to see every single day. So I think that there's good opportunity to collect that data. Is that what you're asking?
I've heard it said that the most dangerous pilots out there are the ones who have something like 500 hours. So they have enough to be comfortable, but they don't have enough. Yeah, they're enough to be dangerous. And so if you get complacent because you're comfortable and you know what you're doing, you may be really good at your job. But if you miss that one little thing, it could be game over. So I was more asking, like, is this something that you see as an opportunity in the simulation, where are your customers catching things like that that they were previously unable to see?
Yeah, and I think that there's kind of another elephant in the room as well, and that's really about trainer bias and, you know, bias against other people. These tools are spatial in nature. They capture exactly what happened, everything that happened, and the total and final outcome of what happened within a particular scenario. It's done without bias, and it's done at scale. I think there's greater opportunity for employees from the ability to get better at their jobs by doing reps in the appropriate, safe way that, you know, the organization has laid out in these, simulations, but also be evaluated in a very standard, way that, provides a very reliable and, consistent outcome.
Yeah, well said. I think that perfectly summarizes the opportunity here at the intersection of human performance and virtual environments, virtual experiences, and training. So I think we're going to have to wrap up on that note. I'd like to ask you two different things. The first one is there anything else that you would like to leave our listeners with? Like, what is the key takeaway for you?
All right. So on the first piece there, I think the biggest thing for your listeners is that there's fantastic opportunities in immersive devices such as virtual, augmented, and mixed reality. And if you have bias towards these technologies based off of the prior capability, you know, maybe back in 2015, 2016, take another look. We're literally getting to the point in this particular industry where there's just such a powerful capability to offer, like I said, aerospace type simulators and training to the workforce and provide the ability to imprint knowledge on your employees unlike any other system that's ever existed before. And I think it's really important that enterprises are looking at this and taking it seriously, especially with the pandemic situation as well. Also creates this opportunity to solve some of these issues with training that was originally done in centralized type ways. So, my final point here would be that, you know, I think that immersive technologies is really the future of learning and knowledge acquisition. And I think it's important that enterprises take a really clear look at it and how it could solve problems internally.
And so how would somebody get in touch with Cognitive? Like, what is the next step that they need to do to go down this road?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can hit us up at cognitive3d.com. There's a lot of different use cases on our website, including case studies that you can get access to. We're happy to give you a demo of the platform and how it works and how it could solve some problems within your organization. We're happy to have a conversation early on in the process and, you know, kind of establish that relationship maybe at the beginning of your project. But if you also have something mature, we're also happy to engage and kind of see where we can add some additional value.
It said like a true partner. So Tony, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.